Started here.
Yeah.
Where's our...
Okay, I think it's time for us to get started. We've got a good program today.
Okay, where's your...
I know,
No, what do you need the other mic? That mic over there. That one.
No, it's standing up.
That one. Push the button on the side. Button on the side. Until it turns green.
Hello.
There you go.
Good evening, everyone. I'm David Alkeck. I'm on the board of the Philosophers Forum. And Dallas Philosophers Forum has been in existence, over 25 years?
Oh, 30.
30 years or more. And it's dedicated to bringing philosophic ideas and related subjects to an interested and educated audience. I hope you are. Students are welcome. And for many of you, I guess, this might be your first time. Raise your hand, is this your first time here? Very good. How did you hear about us?
Internet.
Great. You can get a copy of our schedule on philosophersforum.org. And I'd like to welcome all of you. I've got to make a few announcements, little housekeeping before we get started. Philosophy isn't free, as I've told. We do have expenses, so you have to pay our treasurer over here with the sweater here, gray-haired guy. $5, and that's Jack Youngkin. And students pay $2, and you get a real bargain, however. If you pay $35, you get a whole year of 20 lectures.
Six months.
I'm sorry. Six months. Well, that's still.
Still a good deal.
Still a good deal. If you've eaten, make sure you pay your... Don't pay the server. Pay the
desk.
You leave. Okay? And turn off your cell phones. Okay, our subject tonight... Dr. John Mears from the SMU History Department is going to speak on seeking meaning through the perspectives of big history. What is big history, you might say? And he's going to tell us, but just as a little introduction, since the 1990s, there's been a growing number of historians that have coordinated with other disciplines such as astrophysics, geology, paleontology, anthropology, and et cetera, to establish a kind of a comprehensive perspective of history, really from the Big Bang to the present. I mean, that's really big history. Professor Mears is world-renowned expert, and we've known each other for 40 years, we've figured, since 1973. He's a specialist in early modern Europe, received his undergraduate education at the University of Minnesota, and his graduate training at the University of Chicago. He's a past president of the World History Association and a member of the recently organized International Big History Association. Having published a range of articles and essays on the subject of big history, he's currently working on what has become a two-volume saga entitled To Be Human, A Perspective on Our Common History. There he sets forth an interpretation of human experience as an integral dimension of the epic of evolution. Professor Mears will address three overriding questions, he tells me. Number one, what is the essential nature of big history? Two, why has it recently developed as a field of research and teaching? And three, what do we gain by putting topics of concern in a framework of cosmic evolution? Our subject tonight is seeking meaning through the perspectives of big history. So without further ado, join me in welcoming Dr. John Mears.
Turn it off and stick it in there.
Someone's wearing hearing aids, so if you're not going to use the...
I project very well.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be a problem, but if it is, let me know. I will talk about the three issues that David raised toward the end of his introduction, but I'll integrate it into my overall talk. And I want to start tonight by talking a little bit about how I became interested in this thing that is now called big history. That is a phrase, big history, that a colleague of mine from Australia, David Christian, coined. Although some of us were in fact beginning to think about what he labeled big history long before he introduced the term. And I think, at least to me, it's kind of interesting how I got involved with big history. It was a process, an evolutionary process over a number of decades that might come as a little surprise when you consider that my research specialty was originally 17th century Austria. I mean, if you want to know something about what was happening in Carinthia in the 17th century, I'm your man. So how did I go from 17th century Austria to this? And I think one of the reasons goes back to my first concerns about studying the past, which began to occur to me in late high school, actually. And what I quickly discovered as I explored this suddenly acquired interest in thinking about the past was that I was particularly drawn to sweeping treatments, epic treatments. I actually decided to go to graduate school in history when I was a junior in high school. And that summer, while I was working on construction crews, I would go home at night and read H.G. Wells' Outline of History, even though he wasn't an historian. But that's an example of the kind of sweeping treatment that I really liked and never quite got over, despite my specialized training. I come from a family of MDs, and therefore had a strong interest in the natural sciences, so that by the time I got out of graduate school, I was reading avocationally in both the sciences, particularly astrophysics, and in anthropology, particularly the rapidly unfolding field of hominid evolution. And then also, almost by accident, as a relatively young professor, I began to work with high school teachers who are assigned the task in high school of teaching young people world history. Most of them, of course, were never trained in anything called world history, so they just had to jump in and do the best they could. I was one academic who began to spend some time working with them in their classes. And as I did that, it strengthened my interest in broader historical perspectives. After I'd been in the profession for a few years, I also became increasingly restive with the intellectual fragmentation of my discipline. I mean, to me, the great power of history is the power of synthesis and integration. And we have grown so committed to the monograph that we now chop up the study of the past in small pieces and never manage to bring them all back together again. And I have to admit, by the time I was in my mid-30s, I was starting to become frustrated by that. And this is what led me into a new organization in the early 1980s called the World History Association, which I became a member and ultimately served as its president for 2 years. What working with, in this new field of world history, the World History Association is concerned with developing the field not only as a teaching, but as a research field. And what participating in the World History Association did was to begin to teach me how to approach the human experience comprehensively, and do so by moving away from the familiar framework of national communities, which is the way much of recent history has been organized. That's beginning to break down, but that was certainly the case when I joined the profession. But world historians tended to look at the past in terms of the transcendent interactions between peoples and cultures, and to do so in a progressively comparative way. One of the consequences of that is that I brought a few books that you don't really need to look at, but I want to call your attention to them just because I want to emphasize there is a growing body of major scholarly works that relate now, increasing number that relate to what we're talking about tonight. And one of the most interesting recent works is by Victor Lieberman, who is a professor of history at the University of Michigan. He was originally a student of pre-colonial Burma, and has evolved into a comparativist who emphasizes very broad trends and themes. Well, his latest two-volume opus is entitled Strange Parallels, Southeast Asia, which is his original specialty, in Global Context, in the period from roughly 800 to 1830. And there are good reasons for those dates that we're not going to go into. But his whole point is to argue that if you look broadly, you can see parallel lines of development, often working out in closely simultaneous ways, that can even link a neglected region like Southeast Asia to the broader trends of world history. And he's written a quite amazing two-volume work that reviewers have either found to be brilliant or found to be absurd, depending on your point of view. But he's gotten some very favorable reviews of what he has done. As I work with world history, it began to occur to me, well, if I really believe in this thing, I ought to be exposing my undergraduates to it. And so I developed a full year world history survey in which, without really fully understanding the field as I know it today, was started with a treatment of cosmic evolution. That is to say, in organizing this year-long course for undergraduates, I put the human historical experience in the framework of cosmic evolution. Long before someone like David Christian came along and named the field for us. If you're really interested in studying a little bit of big history, his book, Maps of Time, recently published by the University of California Press, is one of the first class introductions to world history and what it's all about. It's a good example of the kind of scholarship in these broad fields that are currently being published by leading university presses. University of California Press has really picked up on big history. Why, I'm not clear, but they published a number of books that fall into this field. He labeled it big history, and essentially what it involves is a study of the past that embraces the whole of time. That means we have to spend much more time deciding what we're not going to talk about than what we are actually going to deal with. By taking this big history approach, we can integrate the evolution of the physical universe with the solar system and our planet, with the origins and development of life forms upon it, leading ultimately to the history of humankind itself. What I did in that survey was to set the stage and establish the context within which my students hopefully would find meaning in the dominant themes of humanity's shared past. And that's what that course was all about. That's what Big History is all about. Now, as growing numbers of us in a wide range of disciplines, at our first international meeting of the Big History Association, we like to start pretentiously. I mean, there were astrophysicists, there were chemists and biologists, there were anthropologists and archaeologists, there were social scientists as well as historians, all in committed to this idea and all in dialogue with one another. For someone who is uneasy with intellectual fragmentation, this is a good thing, to have this happen. For those of us who have become devotees, of course, our challenge is to try to convince audiences, popular audiences, academic audiences, that this is a good idea. And in doing that, we sometimes succeed partially. At least our audiences in the various panels I've been on at professional meetings and whatnot, the audiences respond to Big History asking a whole range of questions that the disciplinary specialists still haven't settled, but we are only beginning to settle, but we are wrestling with significant problems that have remained unresolved. How do cosmologists explain the origins of galaxies in the early universe? I think astrophysicists are much better able, are getting closer to being able to do that now than they were 25 years ago. How do chemists understand the emergence of life forms out of matter? How are we to understand that? It's something that is not in... Our politicians may be clear about the origins of life and know exactly when it happens. What I've discovered is chemists and biologists are not quite as certain, are not able to pin it down with the precision of our politicians. whatever you want to make of that. How do historians, and this was important to me, integrate what we once called prehistory, the domain of the archaeologist and the anthropologist, with what has happened to humankind in the last 5 millennia? It struck me a long time ago, those two parts of the history of our species should not be divided that way. They're divided for the convenience of academics, and thereby they cut their largest topic in half and keep them neatly separated, constantly arguing, of course, over academic turf, departmental turf, which is a big thing that university professors do.
Oh, yeah.
I've got someone who has experienced what I'm talking about. But what interests me is that over and over again, they have raised more basic quandaries into the discussion of these sessions. And while those quandaries, while those sources of uneasiness take a variety of forms, the overwhelming majority, it seems to me, have fallen into two categories. The first is probably understandable if what you're dealing with is high academic specialization. The first is uncertainty over why big history makes any difference. Why should we take the trouble to do this? Isn't it just easier if you write a little something on 17th century Austria that you can kind of focus on and pin down for, with archives waiting for you in Vienna and elsewhere? What have you actually accomplished once you complete your task? How does anything that happened prior to the Holocene, including hominid evolution, significantly affect our approaches to human history? I would argue it makes a great deal of difference, but as you can tell, I'm different already. But you have to keep in mind that the majority of my colleagues are monographists, and don't get me wrong, I read monographs all the time. They're extremely valuable and important. But that's where they confine themselves mostly, and most of them, although they call themselves historians, are dealing with topics that deal with the last couple hundred years. I would say 80% of recent written history deals with the period from roughly 1750 to the present. Very interesting. We're supposed to be historians. And yet, the deep past largely eludes the discipline, I would argue. I make my departmental colleagues very nervous talking this way. But in any case, these are legitimate questions they raise. And it's something that I think has to be dealt with. The other cluster of objections or questions is more difficult to deal with because those questions are grounded in people's values and beliefs, particularly their religious beliefs. But after all, if big history relies heavily on the natural sciences, there are issues there for religious conservatives in our time. Very understandable problems. The problem often is that their responses are very emotionally charged, usually. You know, if I start talking about, well, you know, the Big Bang, it's now, by the way, 13.8 billion years ago. My friends in astrophysics have decided recently there's another 100 million years that needs to be taken into consideration. But again, this is all fair enough. If you stop to think about it, big history challenges head-on traditional thinking, customary religious teachings, and does so in ways that offer very little room for accommodation because the scenarios that we develop do tend to rest on highly secular views of reality. That is true. What I've discovered in the case of this objection is that when advocates of big history, like myself, are challenged by members of the audience on these kinds of grounds, and some of the challenges come from trained academics, by the way, who are objecting to conclusions that rest so heavily on modern science. My colleagues tend to respond to that by reciting the usual things that are said about science and religion, for example, which operate in different realms with different sets of assumptions and purposes. But so far as I can determine, these ready responses to this second set of objections seldom resolve the issue. Because we can't get over some of the points of view that our inquisitors start with. It's difficult for us to get there. So if that is the case, what are we to make of the resulting standoff? And I would ask, how can we respond to it more effectively than we have? So what I want to do is to begin to make my points by offering responses to these two quandaries that I thought about a bit in terms of the study of world history. In the case of the first set of objections, what do we gain by placing the appearance of anatomically modern humans on our tiny planet within the framework of cosmic evolution, allowing our imagination to stretch over some 3.8 billion years. By the way, if you want to read just one interesting book that encapsulates much of the research that has been done in the last several decades, I would recommend Eric Chasen's The Epic of Evolution. He is an anthropologist at Harvard University, but he has developed this approach to the epic of evolution, which he divides into seven different ages or epochs. So you've got the particle epoch, for example, the galactic epoch, and so forth. But this would give you, in one admittedly dense book, a good summary of cosmic thinking about much of the structure of big history, of what we now call big history. But what you find in this book is that, and what you find, I think, by participating in the big history movement, is that this is an emerging field from which we clearly can acquire an altered sense of our ultimate place in the enormous scheme of things. Because after all, current levels of understanding, starting with astrophysics and ending up with historians and social scientists, can allow us to trace everything we can encounter in the universe, including our own origins, back to common beginnings. And we can grasp their connectedness to the larger whole. But that's what the framework of big history is all about. Now, when we do that, and we're thinking about ourselves, and what do we ego-driven beings do but think about ourselves? Maybe we think about something beyond that, but not much. When set a bit against the cosmic backdrop, the study of big history seems initially to make us seem inconsequential. And I like to put this to undergraduates. I say, look at what the scientists have done to us. Here we are, relatively modest beings, living out lives of roughly the biblical 3 score years and 10. It's getting a little longer for many of us, but relatively short lives. We exist on one of the smaller planets, rotating around, let's face it, a second-rate star, if we're talking about size, and not even located in the center of our galaxy, but closer to the fringes of our galaxy. A galaxy itself made up of hundreds of billions of stars in an infinite expanding universe consisting of billions of galaxies. So where does science leave us? And I think that's a reasonable question to ask. And I love to make undergraduates uncomfortable by talking to them about this. As an educator, I see my task as semi-ministerial, to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I've discovered that a lot of 19-year-olds are very comfortable with themselves. In fact, for all their supposed neuroses and whatnot. Here we are, a very young and, may I say, immature species. Our survival as a species has been very brief by cosmic standards. We have, in terms of longevity, we have a long way to go to match the humble cockroach. We're not as big as we think we are, in terms of, it remains to be seen. And being a young species, I would argue as an historian, we are also very immature. Which is something we can get into if you would really like to. Here is big, you know, when we think about our position in the largest possible terms, we can't help but be struck by the jarring juxtapositions of the extraordinary range of accomplishments that human beings have worked out as over and against our equally extraordinary shortcomings. It's really quite amazing. And yet, big history is like the cavalry that at that point arrives just in time for the rescue, because the fundamental connectedness of the universe, which big history emphasizes, can have the effect of reinforcing our sense of significance. After all, big history allows us to delineate clear continuities running back to the formation of simple atoms out of energy, galaxies out of shapeless matter, heavy elements out of the stars, and under certain discernible combinations of circumstances, the molecular building blocks of life out of heavy elements. We can proceed through big history. A shared starting point of energy and matter, a shared origins of physical bodies that make up, say, the solar system, the kindred nature of every organism on the face of the earth, all plants and animals on this earth share a significant percentage of their DNA with one another. A DNA with one another. Their genetic coding.
About 98%, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we share 98 or 99% with our closest cousins, the chimpanzees. Yeah. There is, in other words, a kindred nature to every organism on the face of the planet. At a time when we're wreaking havoc with nature, I think that's an important thing we might remember. We find that many of the atoms essential for existence of our planet and our own physical bodies were forged deeply in the interiors of the earliest stars, and that the natural unfolding of the cosmos ultimately produced the wonders of terrestrial life. The solar system, big history helps us to realize, most likely contained the potential for our being from the very outset of its evolution. Now, the assurance we receive from a recognition of all-embracing relationships is fortified by our sense that everything changes continuously throughout the universe in accordance with certain recurring tendencies. Again, this is something that I have a few aphorisms that I throw out to my undergraduates. I like to insist to them that the only thing they will encounter in their lives that is unchanging is the ceaseless change of everything they encounter.
Amen.
And they all kind of look at me like, I finally have gone around the bend. But it's an example of how you can use big history to kind of work with them a bit in ways that they don't necessarily anticipate. What's interesting in retrospect to me, for myself, is how early on I recognized some of this. By the mid-1980s, I was writing articles and essays related to what we call big history. And in one of them, I asserted, and here's the sentence I wrote in 1984, every discipline, I argue, embraces an element of historicity. You know, the geologist's interest in the history of the planet, the astrophysicist's interest in the history of the cosmos, and so forth. Every discipline is connected in one way or another with how the relationship patterns between apparently disparate phenomena alter over time. And whatever our disciplines, we discover when we observe the evolutionary process over long spans of time, a persistent direction in the order and sequence shaped by our minds. I can't believe I wrote this in 1984. Maybe it was a significant year. A direction that moves things from the singular to the plural, from the homogeneous to the heterogeneous, from the simple to the complex. The theme of gradually growing complexity is one of the dominant themes of big history, from isolation to integration. I guess that's where I started with big history. We discover through big history a persistent, there may be ups and downs, but a persistent direction in the order and sequence that we shape with our minds. We're dealing with self-organizing propensities. That's very difficult for my undergraduates to get their minds around. Self-organizing propensities appear to be embodied in the very character, the very dynamics of the universe itself, giving it intrinsic power, after all, to generate ever more differentiated forms out of what already exists. Quite amazing if you stop to think about things that weren't there, they're suddenly there. If you take two atoms of hydrogen and put them together with one atom of oxygen, lo and behold, you've got something that wasn't there before, water. Now, just if you put those together in a certain way. And that's just a simple example of this self-generating propensity. Now, in talking about this, we should take care to disassociate these pervasive tendencies from the idea that cosmic events advance inexorably toward predetermined goals. Instead of undeviating development, we find what we wrestle with is a set of evolutionary processes replete with false starts and blind alleys. But we may still, I think, reasonably conclude that major developments do not occur in an entirely accidental or random fashion. Irrespective of the variations we find in discrete structures, the universe does seem nearly the same wherever we look. Now, when we sent men to the moon, we assumed that physics was going to operate basically the same way it did there as on the planet Earth, even if such things as the force of gravitation was different. The basic qualities of matter and energy, we presume, are always constant. Fundamental evolutionary dynamics apparently never fundamentally vary. And we can therefore infer, as the scientists who made the scientific revolution of the 17th century came to conclude, that similar causes will yield similar effects. Newton spent some time on that in his Rules of Reason in philosophy. And therefore, should conditions that transform the Earth into a living planet, if that combination of circumstances, should they be replicated in other parts of the universe, the predictable results would be something close, but not identical to, the life forms that we know on this planet. Our existence, in other words, is not an improbable fluke. It's built into the possibilities of the universe if the conditions, the combination of conditions, are right. The potential of our being may have therefore been contained within the solar system from the very outset, and perhaps the presence of such indispensable components of life as amino acids prior to the formation of the Earth helps to demonstrate that, perhaps, if we want to do that. Well, if our view of the evolutionary epoch does have some meaning-giving purposes, and yet if it is not entirely but largely grounded in the natural sciences, if we're going to take the full scope of big history. If that's the case, what can we say then to those who view the past from more traditional and in particularly more religiously oriented perspectives? How can we bridge the gap between our science-based explanations, which we big historians love, and widely held religious views, or philosophical views, or simply social values? How do we do that? Well, I've got some tentative responses to that as well. Why not? I live dangerously. We might find at least modest comfort in reminding ourselves that some of the greatest scientists of the modern age have not viewed science and philosophy, or even science and religion, as irreconcilable. And one of the most important of that was no less a figure than Albert Einstein. He wrote a lot of philosophical essays after the First World War. And maybe it was set off by the long dialogue he had with Sigmund Freud, in which the two men tried to explain how this war came about in the first place. And each had theories, particularly Freud, that related to their own thought processes. But you can get, by the way, many of his writings, his more philosophical writings, in a series of inexpensive and readily available paperback at Amazon.com or any one of the big bookstores. But Three Rivers Press has published many of them, and one of the most valuable for my purposes is a book called Ideas and Opinions. And this is where this quotation I'm going to use from Einstein comes from. But Einstein, interestingly enough, developed an interpretation of religion that implied a dependence of science on a religious attitude. Hang on to your chairs here. This is not John Muir speaking, this is Albert Einstein speaking. And you can do with this what you will. While it is true, Einstein asserted, that scientific results are entirely independent from religious or moral considerations, at least in theory, those individuals to whom we owe the great creative achievements of science were all of them imbued with the truly religious conviction that this universe of ours is something perfect and susceptible to the rational striving of knowledge. Individual existence impressed them, individual existence, you know, the kind of individualism that Americans love. Individual existence impressed them, these great scientists, as a sort of prism. And they wanted to experience the universe as a single significant whole. Einstein said he was above all motivated by the ultimate mystery of the universe. I'm never going to be able to answer all my own questions. I or no one else, no matter where science takes us, is going to be able to figure everything out. Nature, the character of the natural world, is ultimately beyond our full comprehension. But the very mystery of it is what makes it ultimately so fascinating. Given that, I would say that given the presuppositions and objectives we have as practitioners of big history, we are surely positioned to transcend, dare I say, some of the more obvious limitations of the scientific enterprise. And all the good scientists I know own up to those limitations. In my opinion, the really good ones do. At the same time that we are drawing heavily on their achievements, recognizing the limitations of the scientific enterprise while we are relying on their achievements. But can we do this in ways that bridge the gap between the theories of science, and I'm going to focus on the teachings of religion for a moment, without blurring the critical differences between the two? Because there are differences. Can we constructively build upon both kinds of knowing to grasp firmly the implications of the evolutionary epoch for the study of human history? My answer to that is a very cautious yes. And I base my position largely on works that, other major works that have been published in the last 20 years or so. Let me just give you a quick example of some very heavy reading that begins to take up some of the issues that I think need taking up. One of them is Roy Rappaport's Ritual and Religion in the Making of Humanity. Religion, mind you. One of the things that was making me restive about my own discipline was the failure of we historians, as I saw it, to pay sufficient attention to the role of religion in human existence. Whatever our religious beliefs, whatever we think of religion, it has obviously been extremely important. And recent scholarship demonstrates why. Merlin Donald has written a very interesting book on the origins of the modern mind, in which he argues for three stages in the evolution of culture and cognition. It's a really fascinating book that deals with issues related to some of the others. What I'm plowing through right now is Robert Bella's latest opus magnum. Robert Bella is a very distinguished Berkeley sociologist, and he has recently come forth with a book that is very valuable to me. You don't have to agree with everything he says in here to see, find it valuable. Religion in Human Evolution, from the Paleolithic to the Axial Age. Notice how broad in scope and interdisciplinary these works are. Just exactly the kind of help that big historians are looking for. But then I'm going to wind down, you'll be glad to know. My basic position about how to respond to people who object to big history on value grounds, and particularly religious grounds, are things I learned, believe it or not, from a Unitarian Universalist minister. I am a Unitarian Universalist of nearly half a century now. There are a number of people in this audience who they don't have to recognize themselves who go to that church, First Unitarian Church of Dallas. And in the early mid-1970s, our senior minister was an Eastern-trained theologian by the name of Dwight Brown. And unexpectedly, really, I was a young academic, not knowing what to anticipate when I went to church, goodness knows, but trying to find a place where we could give some religious education to our children. Unexpectedly, the sermons I heard him deliver in the early and mid-70s played a major role in the ultimate shaping of my ideas about big history, interestingly enough. This is another way in which I completely perplex my colleagues. Maybe it's just me, but they do not understand what I'm doing. And maybe I should just leave it at that. A brief summary of his key principles will hardly do justice to Reverend Brown's very rich theology, but it can provide some indication of how we might respond to the religious anxieties provoked by our scholarship as big historians. Dwight Brown spent two decades of his career to the task of convincing his parishioners, first in Dallas and then in the Cleveland area, that venerable religious teachings and practices, while replete with wisdom we must not lose, no longer provide adequate guidance and support in the midst of the tumult of our times. This is an idea that is becoming much more common. A very distinguished Harvard theologian by the name of Harvey Cox has recently come out with a book called The Future of Faith, in which that is exactly what he argues. He doesn't want to give up on terms like the concept of God, but he insists we're probably going to have to redefine it and think about our religious practices in different ways to keep them abreast of the very different kinds of times we are now living in. A transformation of belief systems, value structures, and modes of expression more in keeping with current realities had, Reverend Brown argued, already begun. And one of the greatest resources we have at our disposal to participate in this transformation involved, he said this in the 1970s, a ministry, involved the fundamental changes being wrought by the recent revolution, the 20th century revolution in physics. That's where he started his sermons on this whole subject. Since the changes that have been overtaking physics in the last century or so, he pointed out, have manifold implications for our lives and for our religious lives in particular. The scientific method encourages us to take things apart, to take a particular aspect of nature, to break that aspect down into its components. And Brown argued in his sermons that this is a very powerful mode of analysis if our aim is to understand the natural world and to manipulate and exploit it. If that's our purpose, then what science does is, as it's currently been practiced in the last 200 or 300 years, is right on target. But if we want to understand what is ultimately real, theologians talk about this all the time, that what appears to be real to us at the immediate moment is not at the deepest level of our lives what is actually real. If we want to understand what is real, especially with regard to the nature of our humanness, and I'm literally using his own phrases here, we must examine the interacting systems of the larger whole. Ultimately, the whole of the universe, the entire cosmic drama, whose patterns taken together reveal the most comprehensive truths about existence. That's a minister talking in the mid-1970s. Quite extraordinary if you stop to think about it. He went on to say that the chief preoccupation of religion, after all, has always been grappling with the whole. Our very word, religion, religio, in its medieval Latin form, originally meant that which binds together. That's the source of that word, that which binds together, instead of divides people. In that case, what modern religion is doing is just exactly the opposite for which it was originally intended, Brown suggested. Far be it from me to suggest anything like this. Religion has persistently sought the largest and most inclusive cosmic patterns which human beings can discover, patterns which they have persistently embodied in the familiar religious name God, which after all is the ancient symbol of the power and majesty of being. Well, Paul Tillich argued that God is the ground of all being, 20th century theologian, and he was already beginning to suggest that we need to think of God in different terms when we use that word. Religion, the essence of which involves an ancient search for the meaning of existence, thus strives relentlessly to bind together more and more of what is known, trying to lift our gaze, as Brown put it, from the grubby details of the daily round, to the transcendent and beautiful in which we live and move and have our being. Just exactly what fascinated Albert Einstein. Just exactly. To connect with this realm of the spirit, this realm, this domain of the divine, domain of the divine, in which the why of existence is the insistent central question, becomes the overriding objective of religious striving. And it just so happens this is the ultimate purpose of big history, in more secular terms. Interestingly enough. From such a perspective, Brown argued, we can imagine how the creative powers of the universe are incorporated in our humanness, and how, though unfolding through the unfolding of our awareness, meaning in the cosmos is defined. Through the development of human potential, he argued, we are active agents in the creative process. There are now scientists who want to call our times the Anthropocene, the period in which human beings have reached a stage where, at least in certain ways, they can shape what happens, you know, to nature and to the rest of what goes on the planet, with all the pitfalls that involves. It is through the development of that potential that we give significance to the cosmos, he argued, Brown argued, as we impart through our personal growth significance to our own lives. In other words, the goal of evolution's creative energy, which in this view becomes simply another way of saying the purpose of God, the Creator. Now, this is Brown, the minister, talking. Is personhood. he suggested. Personality not only as we know it, but the process of personal development extended as far onward and upward as we can conceive it. Well, by the time he got entranced, I have to admit being entranced with what he was delivering from the pulpit. Just at a time when my ideas of what we now call big history were gestating. So, in my own efforts to grapple with this second set of objections to our understanding of big history, I want to end with several caveats. I'm not trying to imply, in using Dwight Brown, that the views of one Unitarian Universalist minister alone has the potential of bringing modern science and contemporary religion into happy harmony. I don't believe that for a minute. I am certainly not wanting to suggest that we accept his mode of thinking in total. I do not believe for a moment that every big historian will find his theological arguments convincing. What I am trying to say is that these ideas do give us hope that the tension scholarship raises between science and religion. And I have, since about the early 70s, it's starting to taper off now, as our society seems to be swinging back from a more conservative period. But beginning in the 1970s, I had increasing numbers of undergraduate university students who came to the university with a strong antipathy toward science. And it reached its peak in the 80s and 90s and seems to be moderating now. It does seem to me that Brown's ideas do give us hope that the tensions scholarship raises between science and religion might be eased, that the objections of the religiously concerned are actually implicit in the story that big history can provide us, and that by following an approach that places theology within the context of cosmic evolution, religion in human evolution, Robert Bell, something of a sociologist of renown, we might be able to impart greater meaning and purpose to the ongoing human adventure. At least, that's why a nice boy like me got mixed up with this thing called history. All right? I think that's probably too much. But there I am.
That's great.
So,
you gotta press the button.
The light's gonna be on.
What else?
Is this light on? You gotta hold it down.
Gotta hold it?
Hold it down until it turns green.
Okay. Yes? Oh. Professor Beers will entertain some questions. I'm going to take a prerogative and ask him the first one. David Christian, one of his main things is thresholds of complexity.
Yes.
And these irreversible kind of quantum leaps from simple elements to chemicals, from chemicals to biology, and then to life. These irreversible thresholds. Can you tell us what you think about these irreversible thresholds of complexity?
Of complexity. Obviously, in the first place, complexity is properly a dominant theme of big history, indisputably, because we find it wherever we, in the unfolding of whatever we happen to be looking at. And that complexity can be momentarily short-circuited or reversed, as we see when great ancient empires, for example, dissolve. The complexity of Roman culture gives way, at least momentarily, to something similar. But the dominant trend is toward greater complexity. Whether it's in physical forms, I mean, our brain, I think, is by far the most complex thing we know of in the universe. It is the last word in complexity that is the basis for our cognitive capacities, our self-conscious awareness, and everything else that is extremely important in defining our humanness. When I look at the full range of human history, from the time of the emergence of anatomically and behaviorally modern humans about 200,000 years ago, it seems to me that there are three periods of relatively rapid transition, which I call transmutations, in which the consequences were significant jumps in the complexity of human behavior and social organizations. And you can see that one of those is with the full maturation of anatomically modern humans that generated what archaeologists call the Upper Paleolithic takeoff. The second was the advent of sedentary food production. And you can get a quick feel for how that augmented the complexity of human existence by considering the way in which the dominant form of social organization, small foraging bands, gave way to much larger and much more complicated agrarian societies. A big jump in complexity. Very briefly, I would argue that one of the reasons our times are so confused and complicated is that we are currently going through a similar kind of jump in complexity that's unfolding before our very eyes.
Another axial age?
Yeah. Something.
Yes. Dr. Mears, I was intrigued by your statement about a man being an immature being, and it reminded me of the book by Stephen Pinker. I just finished reading The Better Angels of Our Nature. Are you familiar with that book? It's a survey, and he argues that man's inhumanity to man is declining, that murder, war, rape is declining. It's a survey. And so I had a two-part question. My first part of the question is, would you consider it to be big history, and also tie that into your comments on man being an immature being and why?
I haven't read the book, so I can't really comment on it directly, but it sounds like it would be a facet of big history. Okay, let me just leave it there.
Okay.
One of the beauties of putting human existence in a cosmic framework is that it does remind us, among many other things, we haven't been around very long. And yet, our self-conscious awareness and our cognitive capacities, while giving us very special kinds of potential attributes, also, of course, is part of our difficulty in recent millennia, to say the least. But human beings, within the kind of societies they've developed, have acquired a capacity for collective accumulating learning that does have an effect on our behavior in the long run. So that ironically, even though we are living in terribly troubled times, in which, among other things, advance of technology has skyrocketed beyond our moral behavior and moral principles, I would argue, I think we are, because we are capable of doing it, learning fast. And even in these chaotic, troubled times, even with chaos inside the Beltway, and whatever else you care to point to, we are, in fact, acquiring the experience and understanding which collectively will never lift us above the parameters of our humanness, but will enable us among other things, potentially to live more successfully together and in relationship to nature. And one of the big challenges of the present age is the sustainability of that. And it's going to take a lot of maturity on our part to sort just that issue out.
A little bit of history as a preface. 50 plus years ago, I arrived at a private junior college, liberal arts sort of college in the mountains of southeastern Kentucky. I was assigned a course in Western Civ and signed a book. Now, I was a little distressed that it seemed to sort of want to jump in with the early Greeks. And so I decided, well, at least maybe take a day or two and talk about something from the beginnings of human beings after then, and did that. A bit later, I got around to reading Herodotus, and well, that was consistent with what he did. But I suspect what you're talking about is a big history calls for a rather radical redefinition of history.
It does indeed.
Herodotus.
It does indeed.
And how would you change that definition?
I wouldn't fundamentally change it. I would simply say that that kind of transformation in the discipline is already beginning to take place. It'll take a while. It'll have to work itself out. It is reflected in the, one of the reasons I brought these books is to illustrate the way in which it's already beginning to happen. But to give you an idea that it is happening, my colleagues in American history, for example, no longer confine the U.S. survey to a national framework, no longer deal with American history in terms of its larger global context, but actually begin with the appearance of Paleo Indians many thousands of years ago. They actually begin the U.S. survey back with the early arrival of humans in the Americas. So even my colleagues in American history have gotten on board. And this is increasingly, it hasn't converted everybody, but increasingly, particularly the younger scholars are doing it.
But you're pushing back beyond the
Much further, yes. And this means collisions with other disciplines. When I first taught my survey to freshmen, my year-long survey, the anthropology department just went crazy. I was trotting on their turf. They literally went nuts on me because I was invading their territory.
To ask a slightly more general question than the one that that David did, about 4 years ago, I saw a video course by Professor David Christian on big history.
Yes.
And in this course, he mentions eight major thresholds.
Yes.
The first one being the Big Bang, number seven being agriculture, and number eight being the modern revolution. And
yes.
I just wondered, do the big history types universally agree that those are the eight thresholds?
It's interesting that the discipline is moving fast right now. And increasingly, we are agreeing on those thresholds. There is a growing consensus of the basic framework we have to deal with. Now, how we move in more detail to analyze the aspects of each period will take a little longer time to evolve. But interestingly enough, those thresholds correspond closely with Eric Chase's epochs in his Epoch of Cosmic Evolution. So there is a growing consensus.
No, wait.
He's next. And then we'll come up here. Yeah.
So I guess I'm wanting a little clarification about what big history does or is going to do in the sense that it seems like we've had two tracks that have developed. We've had the natural science track of inquiry, and we had the religious track of inquiry. The natural science track gathers information, does experiments, et cetera, et cetera. And the religious track, they just made stuff up.
Well, that's what Neil Durkheim said.
Well, he wasn't right about everything.
But
he was wrong about a whole
bunch. On that point, he was correct. So you're making us. Well,
it seems like to me you're making a lot of statements that beg the obvious. To say that we recognize more complexity, or we're going to another level of complexity, or that the fact that we share a lot of DNA, or the reason they use fruit flies to do so much research is because the protein structure of fruit flies is very safe. So the question is,
well, there is a question.
What does big history do? I mean,
well, I tried to answer.
Well, I didn't get it. I obviously sense network. Well, I mean, we're pretty good eventually of, I mean, to me it's stating the obvious to say we know that because we finally figured it out. Okay, so is big history, are you explaining things? Are you describing things?
In the first,
synthesizing
things? Let me stick right at home. The implications of big history are not obvious to my students. By a long shot.
I want to know what it is. I don't know what the implication, I don't know what that word means, but what are you trying to do?
It's different.
Develop a sense of the long-term interconnected unfolding of things of which we are an integral part. And we therefore cannot understand ourselves by separating ourselves out as a distinct entity. In some ways we are special, and in many ways we are not.
So it's kind of is it analogous to doing it, coming up with a holistic or systematic scientific view, if you will?
In a way, yeah, to be compared to that, yeah. One of the reasons I started out this the way I did was because I did not have an instant aha moment. My sense of pursuing what we now call big history and my sense of what might be done with it and why it might be worthy evolved literally over half a century. So if you don't get it the first time around, I didn't get it.
I'm trying to understand what you're trying to accomplish. Okay,
what I'm trying to accomplish is to put small pieces together in a larger whole. How's that for a
question? Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, no, you mentioned there's one particular there's a label, and I've forgotten that label, that undergraduates are extremely hard understand. And would you give me
they
that?
They have a difficulty.
Could you give me that understanding, that label again, as you remember it?
Of undergraduate?
I don't know that I have a label to put on them.
Of undergraduate. Well, you said that this was extremely hard for the undergraduate to get their mind around.
History does involve big ideas that they're not accustomed to thinking about. And not only that, they've been raised in a way that has given them a sense of antipathy toward those ideas. An inherent. I was told by one of my students, this is a university student, I was told by this student that when he went off to SMU, his parents said to him, just as soon as your professors start talking about evolution, turn them off.
First of all, we share a history at the Unitarian Church with Clive Brown. But what I wanted to ask you is a philosophic question. In philosophy of history, some of us have the attitude that, or thinking that there is not one history, there is a multiplicity of history.
Sure.
And it's a mistake to use the singular. We should always use the plural, history.
I very much agree with that.
The second point was the religion is no doubt the catalyst in developing civilization. But just because it is does not give it any verity. It doesn't prove the truth of religion whatsoever. It just shows it was the catalyst that caused civilization.
I got answers, responses, not answers, to both of those things, both of those points. Big historians themselves start out with the assumption that history properly practiced should draw upon a wide range of perspectives and scopes of investigation. So it's not that we want to rule out the narrow focused investigation. Those are very valuable to us. What we're saying is we don't want our fellow historians to confine themselves to that scale of observation. That the most effective way of wrestling with the past is to try to deal with it on multiple scales. And big history itself requires the use of multiple scales. You can't stay forever in the realm of broad generalizations. Even big historians can't do that.
But I was talking about individual histories, geological history, universal history. There's a million different histories.
Depends on who tells his story.
Big historians agree with you.
But we live in one world and they all come together.
So what I'm trying to say is we should never talk about big history in that sense, because you can't reduce it down to one great big idea.
Big historians would not say that.
Well, thank you. I want to be clear on that.
Okay. And operate at all scales of observation.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Yeah. I have one.
I forgot your second question. Maybe we can talk about that later.
Religion as a catalyst to civilization.
Well, I always think it's valuable to think that there's always something before something else, at least before the Big Bang we don't know. I mean, no one can say that. So that this is the only universe that there is, no one can say that. It's the only universe we have. Well, the only universe we can know. But I don't see something. You kind of remind me of the great chain of being, and the way you're looking at the world, in a sense, that there's an ongoing evolutionary progression through more and more complexity. It seems to me you leave out the other side, which is in the second principle of thermodynamics, that complex structures depend upon the input of energy to maintain their sense of complexity.
Because growing complexity requires more energy flow.
That's right. And without that, you get disintegration.
Absolutely.
And disintegration is as much a part of our reality. And the return to more simple forms, as all of us will do, in fact, in our lifetime, right? You know, and it's not necessarily a progressive march toward...
I explicitly denied that. Okay? If you were listening. I explicitly denied that. You want me to read it from the text again? Just a second. Hang on, just a second. Obviously, what you're talking about is something that big historians need to grapple with. This is why big historians, to some degree, have at least a curiosity about the future. And in the very long future, of course, our sun will die. And as you put it, the world in which we live will cease to exist as we know it. That's part of living. Another minister friend of mine once said that religion is a human way of dealing with the dual realities of our life. That we are alive and someday will die. And ultimately wrestling with that fundamental dual reality is one way of understanding what religion is all about. And the same thing can be said about big history at whatever scale you care to deal with it. But you might remember I was talking about the way in which big historians do not want this thought of in a deterministic fashion, in terms of an inevitable progression of things. That's, you have to take the false starts and the blind, you know, the dead ends into consideration.
And I agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. A troublemaker in the back.
Couple of thoughts. I think it's kind of interesting, and I do like the fact that you're taking you're kind of breaking the Western mold of exclusionary thinking and going for a much more holistic thing.
That's part of what big history is all about.
Yeah. And the other thing that's probably more important locally is, where does the Texas School Board Commission come from on big history?
I have given up on trying to fathom the Texas School Board. And the answer is no one.
So.
Professor?
Yeah.
Here, I took a class from you 3 years ago, and it was history from the French Revolution since then. It took me 3 years and six more history classes to unpack all those ideas that you put in that one class. In the last 2 hours, you have given me the same feeling. That was taking me 3 years and maybe more than 3 years to unpack all those
ideas. This is why I leave undergraduates in despair. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. That's what I wanted to say.
Let me...
13.8 billion years.
Yeah, 8.
I mean, in a way, think of it in this fashion. Think of the Grand Canyon. It is legitimate to walk through the Grand Canyon and learn in great detail about the flora and fauna and the rock formations of a given part of it. That is a legitimate study of the Grand Canyon. We can also stand on the rim of the Grand Canyon and suddenly begin to see features of the Grand Canyon that walking through its floor we would not be able to find. Or, thirdly, we could hover over the Grand Canyon in a helicopter and see patterns and forms of the Grand Canyon that would completely escape of us if we were standing on just one part of its edge. So you see different things by changing the scale of your observation.
Perspective.
Exactly.
Is this enough? One thing, and I know you kind of touched this, but is there an innate impetus, I think you call it a self-generated propensity that drives the universe to complexity? You know, if physics allows chemicals, if chemicals allow biology, if biology allows development of conscious beings, is there something innate, something in it that pushes it toward, you know, that final goal? And I'm not necessarily talking about supernatural.
We really need the help of the scientists here, but there appears to be. Yeah. Starting with the very formation of the first element. What caused that to happen?
It was driving towards something.
Because the elements, relatively speaking, were more complex than the original chaos of the cosmic soup.
Emergent. It wasn't created. It emerged.
And it seems to go against the second law of thermodynamics, too.
Something has to, or else wrong. And
nothing is destroyed in the second law. It just loses its ability to work. Mm-hmm. But it's still there.
That's enough.
Two little things. Next time, Kant's moral imperative. Is it moral? Is it imperative? Where does it come from? By Greg Grant, Dallas Seminary.
Oh, you did.
And then, is capitalism stable? And what does it mean by our own Wynne Gilbreth? So that's your next two for the year.
That's right.
If I haven't agitated you, I haven't succeeded.
Well, you obviously did make
it. Just remember that.
No, but it's so much of it I agree with.
That's right. He was talking about what you did.
Testing.
Yeah.
This might work.
I'm talking about a couple of things.
All right.